Oh, or to forestall the claim by buying back the stolen goods at a substantial discount? Stone had recently been involved in such a transaction with Arthur Steele involving a stolen work of art. Perhaps the latter, he said. With that in mind, don't you think that Arthur Steele might be willing to get into bed with a whore? I mean, he would just be haggling over the price, would he not?
Lance, I don't think that is a metaphor Arthur would appreciate.
Then don't put it to him that way, Stone. Speak to the man as a lawyer and a member of his board.
And who is going to speak to Gino Bellini?
Why, you are, of course. Who better to operate in medias res?
Stone did not immediately reply.
Oh, Lance said apologetically, would you like to look that up?
I know what it means, Lance, Stone replied with some heat.
So you'll get in touch with both parties?
I don't exactly have Mr. Bellini's phone number, Lance.
Lance placed a card on the desk. As a matter of fact, earlier today, Mr. Bellini got himself down to the Apple store and bought a new phone with a new number, and he is likely to be very impressed to learn that you already have it. That might put him off balance just a bit, don't you think? Give you a leg up in the negotiations?
Stone looked at the card as if it were a coiled viper. Lance pushed it closer to him.
Can't hurt to give it a try, can it?
Lance, how the hell do you get information like this so quickly?
I have 21,660 employees to do the research, Lance replied.
How much did the Chinese offer Bellini for the crown jewels? Stone asked.
That information is a bit more difficult to come by, but I should think somewhere in the region of $25 to $50 million, Lance said. He shrugged. Just a guess, of course.
I think that Arthur Steele is going to find that a difficult starting point for a negotiation, Stone replied.
30. Stone and Meg had dinner in his study. Bob, now bereft of Sugar's companionship, dozed fitfully beside the fire. You know, Meg said, I think I prefer dining in this room to any restaurant I have ever gone to.
Thank you, Stone said.
I should thank Bob as well.
He makes it feel like home. Why have you deprived the poor dear of Sugar?
Sugar, alas, is a member of a family across the street, and I don't think they would accede to Bob's wishes in the matter.
I'm sure Sugar misses Bob, too.
Then she will have to find a way of expressing her desire to her family before we are likely to enjoy her company again.
Maybe dogs should be acquired in braces, she said.
As fond as I am of Bob, I'm not sure I can handle two of him.
Oh, well. There's something I have to tell you about, Stone said.
Uh-oh. Not something bad, necessarily, just something I think you would prefer to know about now rather than later, when you might blame me for keeping it from you.
She looked at him suspiciously. Does this knowledge involve another woman?
No, no, Stone replied quickly. It's entirely a business matter.
Oh.
I had a visit from an acquaintance late this afternoon who has managed to learn that Gino Bellini left Harmony Software with more than his talents and skills in his pocket.
What? Did he steal the silver?
Worse, the crown jewels.
And what would those consist of? She asked.
All the designs and specifications of your driverless car, Stone said. She stared at him, speechless.
And how did your acquaintance come by that knowledge? She asked finally.
He has a rather large staff devoted to the unearthing of such information.
Do you regard his information as reliable?
About as reliable as one can get in an unreliable world. But what could Gino do with it? It would take him months, maybe years, to build a duplicate car. By that time, we'd be in full production.
His intent, apparently, is to sell the files, Stone said.
But abroad?
I'm trying to think who would be a buyer capable of using the design.
Keep thinking.
Her eyebrows went up.
Russia?
I don't think they would have the technical capacity. There is a story that during World War II, an American bomber crew were forced to land their disabled B-17 Flying Fortress in Siberia. Stalin ordered the airplane confiscated and reproduced, down to the last rivet.
And?
And when the Russians were finished, their airplane weighed so much it could not fly.
I think the Russians have become more technically adept since that time.
And so has the technology become more daunting.
The Koreans might manage it, I suppose.
Think bigger.
The Chinese?
Stone nodded.
The Chinese have the designs for my car?
No, my acquaintance managed to block such a sale. Don't ask how. I didn't.
So Gino is looking for another buyer?
It would seem so. My acquaintance has suggested another means of blocking a sale.
How?
Let me ask you. Harmony is insured by the Steel Group, is it not?
We are.
And in the event of a theft of technology, Steel would have to pay.
They would.
What are the limits of your policy in such a case?
Meg wrinkled her brow.
I believe it's $100 million.
They'd have to lay off half of it to Lloyd's of London.
My acquaintance has suggested that I approach Arthur Steele with the notion of buying your designs and specifications back from Gino, with Steele's money.
She thought about it for a minute.
What a good idea, she said, brightening. Stone met Arthur Steele for lunch at a club on the Upper East Side, of which they were both members, one so low-key that it didn't have a name. It was called The Club by its members. Arthur shook out his napkin and spread it over his lap. A waiter took their order, and Arthur took another sip of the martini he had started at the bar.
"Now, Stone, what's on your mind, and how much is it going to cost me?"
"Let me put it this way, Arthur. It's going to save you $75 million.
Arthur looked at him suspiciously.
"You sound like my late wife telling me how much she saved me shopping the sales."
"She saved you $75 million.
"I'm not sure I can afford to save that much money."
"Well, it beats the alternative," Stone said.
"And what is the alternative?"
Stone explained as gently as he could what had occurred, not mentioning any names.
"I'd like to offer Bellini $25 million. Your company's liability, as you know, is $75 million. "Is Lance Cabot involved in this?" Arthur demanded.
"Lance is the source of my information, but he is going to great lengths not to be involved in it. He has already managed to prevent a sale to China, but now he is walking backwards as fast as he can."
Their food was served, and Arthur tried his Dover sole.
"Meg has not filed a claim, has she?"
"No, but it would take her less than a business day to do so."
"I can't go to the board and tell them that one of its members has filed a huge claim. It would be huge, I expect."
"She places a value of $500 million on the stolen property, which means, given your liability limit, you'd save $400 million. Can you afford to save that much?"
Arthur suffered a brief fit of coughing.
"God, it's difficult to be in the insurance business these days," he said. "What should we offer this Bellini, Stone?"
"Offer $20 million and settle for $25 million.
"I was afraid you were going to say that."
"You might remember, Arthur, that your group owns a very large chunk of Harmony software.
If the designs were sold, you would suffer a great deal more than what it costs to buy off Bellini. Harmony's stock would plummet, and you know what you paid for your share. Arthur gulped down the rest of his martini and chased it with another gulp of his wine. Then he set down his glass and applied his napkin to his forehead.
"Oh, Christ, go ahead," he whimpered.
31. Stone drove back to the offices of the Steel Group with Arthur, then they went up to his office.
"All right," Arthur said. "How do you want to do this?"
"I want you to cut me checks for $10, $15, $20, and $25 million made out to Bearer."
"And if you should get mugged on the way to see Bellini, or should you yield to temptation and take a South American vacation, it will cost me, let's see, $70 million?
"Should either of those things occur, Arthur, you can always stop payment," Stone replied.
"Do you have a check format that is very official-looking?"
"The checks on our claim account satisfy that requirement."
"Good. Let's not keep Mr. Bellini waiting." Arthur picked up a phone and pressed a button.
"Mr. Harvey, this is Arthur Steele. Please cut 4 checks on our claims account in the amounts of $10, $15, $20, and $25 million, and hand-carry them to me for my signature." He listened for a moment. "Yes, those are the correct amounts. And please, hurry."
He hung up and looked at Stone.
"I expect that Mr. Harvey has suffered a coronary, and that someone is calling 911 as we speak. If he does show up, be prepared to wait while he argues with me."
"I'll summon all my patients," Stone said.
He picked up a Wall Street Journal from Arthur's desk and began perusing it. Arthur sat, drumming his fingers on his desk. After 10 minutes of this, a man walked in carrying a file folder. He was wearing an ordinary business suit, but Stone imagined him in a green eyeshade and sleeve garters, with ink-stained hands.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Steele," the man said. "Good afternoon, Mr. Harvey."
He nodded toward Stone.
"This is Mr. Barrington."
Harvey turned and stared at him. "I'm the delivery boy," Stone said. Harvey handed the file folder to Steele, but didn't immediately release it from his grip.
"I'll need a signed claim payment memo for each of these checks," he said. "Mr. Harvey," Arthur replied, "let go of the fucking file."
He gave it a yank, and it slipped from Harvey's grip.
"Mr. Steele." "That will be all, Harvey. Don't let the doorknob hit you in the ass on your way out."
Harvey backed his way to the door, let himself out, and closed it softly behind him.
"You'll have to forgive Mr. Harvey," Arthur said, opening the file. "He lets go of money reluctantly."
"I noticed," Stone replied. Arthur spread out the checks, took an expensive pen from his pocket, uncapped it, and let it hover over the desk as he carefully read the amounts on each.
"Arthur..." "All right, all right."
Arthur spat, then signed each check. He took an envelope from his desk, tucked the checks into it, and handed it to Stone.
"They are arranged in ascending amounts," he said to Stone. "Don't, for God's sake, hand him the wrong one, or even worse, all of them."
Stone tucked the envelope into an inside pocket, stood up, and shook Steele's hand.
"At the next board meeting, Arthur, I'll tell them how reluctant you were to let go of these checks." "I want 3 of them back by the close of business today," Arthur said.
Stone went downstairs and got into the rear seat of the Bentley. Then he got out his cell phone, found the card Lance had given him, and gave the address to Fred. 10 minutes later, Fred pulled up to a tall, skinny building. Stone got out, went inside, then dialed Bellini's number.
"Hello?"
a male voice said hesitantly.
"Mr. Bellini, this is Stone Barrington. I think you are acquainted with the name." "How did you get this number?" Bellini asked incredulously.
"It was posted on the public bulletin board at the Apple Store," Stone replied, "with a thumbtack."
Bellini made a gargling sound.
"I'm downstairs in your building, and I have a great deal of money for you. Please buzz your front desk and instruct them to admit me."
"I don't understand.
If the desk clerk doesn't pick up his phone in 10 seconds, I'm leaving and taking the money with me."
He hung up.
5 seconds later, a phone on the front desk rang, and the attendant picked it up.
"Yes, Mr. Bellini?"
"Of course, sir."
He hung up.
Are you Mr. Barrington?"
he asked Stone.
"I am."
"Will you please take the elevator to the 29th floor?"
"Thank you."
Stone walked to the elevator and pressed the button. The car rose, creating a G-force that pressed Stone into his shoes, then glided to a stop. The door opened directly into a vestibule, and a thickly built man, about 6 feet tall, dressed in black trousers and a white shirt, no tie, and clutching a semi-automatic handgun, addressed him.
"What do you want?"
Stone brushed past him, ignoring the gun, walked into a large living room with spectacular views, selected a chair next to another, and seated himself.
"I'm Stone Barrington. Shall we get down to business?" he asked, indicating the other chair.
Bellini walked over and sat down, placing the pistol on the coffee table, within easy reach.
"Let me begin," Stone said, "by stating some irrefutable facts. You have taken, without authorization, the designs and specifications of a self-driving automobile from Harmony Software, and attempted to sell it to the Chinese."
"No, I—" "Shut up," Stone said. "I'll tell you when it's time to talk." Bellini shut up. Stone took the envelope from his pocket, extracted the first check, and handed it to Bellini.
"Read this," he said.
Bellini read it.
"That is an official check on the account of the Steel Group of insurers in the amount of $10 million. It is in payment for the return of all the files you stole from Harmony. You may hand them over to me now and keep the check. I assure you it will not bounce."
"I'm afraid," Bellini began.
"That is the carrot," Stone said. "Now the stick. If you are unwise enough to reject this offer and produce the files forthwith, you will be arrested and charged with hiring one Joe Cross and a companion to murder your former employer, Miss Harmon.
But I should tell you that before Mr. Cross expired, he told two police officers and an emergency medical technician that you had hired him to commit murder. Those two police officers are waiting downstairs in a car to arrest you."
"But I don't—"
"However," Stone said, "if you accept this arrangement and produce the files, I am authorized to tell you that the testimony of the witnesses will be withheld, and you will not be prosecuted for murder by hire. Time to decide, Mr. Bellini. Do you accept?"
"But," Bellini said, and this time he was not interrupted, "I've already sold everything."
32. Stone's first impulse was to grab the weapon on the coffee table and strike Bellini on the head with it, but he restrained himself.
"All right, Mr. Bellini," he said. "Let's see if we can extricate you from your fatal error. Did I mention that Maine still has the death penalty?"
Stone had no idea whether this was true, but he was becoming desperate.
"No," Bellini replied. "You did not. Once you are in custody, which action will take about 3 minutes, all will be lost. Do you understand?"
"But what can I do?" Bellini whined. "The designs are gone."
"To whom did you sell them?" Stone asked.
"To a man named Owaki."
Stone tried not to let his jaw drop.
"Selwyn Owaki?"
Stone had read about this man. He was reputed to be the largest seller of illegal arms in the world.
That is correct.
How long ago?
Bellini looked at his wristwatch.
About 20 minutes before you arrived.
For how much?
$20 million.
And how did you receive these funds?
They were wired to an offshore bank account.
Did you deal with Awaki personally?
No.
With whom did you deal?
A man named Beria, a Russian.
Mr. Bellini, Lavrenti Beria is dead. He was shot by the NKVD many years ago.
Not Stalin's Beria. This one is Stanislav, a distant cousin, I believe.
In what form did you give him the files?
I transferred them to a laptop computer he brought with him.
But the original files are still on your computer?
No, he insisted I erase them while he watched.
Mr. Bellini, you must be very careful to tell me the truth now. Your freedom and eventually your life are at stake. Do you understand that?
Yes, I understand.
You still have all the files in your possession, do you not?
Well,
what medium are they on? Discs? Thumb drives?
A 100 gigabyte thumb drive.
Where is it?
Bellini reached into a trouser pocket, produced a fat black thumb drive, and set it on the coffee table.
Where is your computer? Stone asked, pocketing it.
In my study, Bellini replied, getting up. This way.
Stone followed him into an adjoining room, where a laptop computer sat on a desk. Stone sat down and inserted the thumb drive into a slot and displayed its contents. He opened several files at random and found drawings and schematics of electronics. He removed the drive, put it back into his pocket, then did a search of the computer for the files, without success.
I told you, Bellini said. He made me erase all the files from my computer.
Here is what you are going to do, Stone said. You are going to call Stanislav Beria and get him back here with his computer. Give him a plausible technical reason. Last chance to save yourself, Mr. Bellini.
Bellini produced an iPhone and did a search for a number.
Wait, Stone said. Send me the contact before you call him.
He produced his own phone and gave Bellini the number. Bellini texted him the contact.
Now, call him, and get him back here.
Bellini called a number.
Stanislav, this is Gino Bellini. Have you opened the files yet?
Thank God. Do not open them on any account, or they will be automatically destroyed, and you have the only copy. Bring your computer back here, and I will remove the danger and make the files accessible without destroying them.
I know, and I'm sorry about that. It was a simple oversight that I can fix in 10 minutes.
Thank you.
He hung up.
Beria is on his way back here. We will be lucky if he doesn't kill us both.
Stone went back into the living room, took the pistol from the coffee table, checked the magazine and the breech, and tucked it into his waistband. Then he had a good look around the room and decided that behind the curtains was the best spot to hide.
He said he was 5 minutes away, Bellini said.
Can you cause the files to be destroyed if he opens them?
Yes, Bellini said. I can even make it possible for him to open them once, but not a second time, without destroying them.
Then that is what you will do. Ask him to open the files to be sure they are safe.
All right.
Stone picked up the check on the coffee table and tucked it back into the envelope in his pocket.
Am I not to be paid?
Bellini asked.
You have already been paid by Beria, Stone said.
He will kill me, Bellini replied.
I'll be behind the curtain with your gun. I'll see that it doesn't happen.
The phone rang and Bellini picked it up.
Please send him up, he said, then hung up. He's on the way up,
he said to Stone. Is he alone?
I don't know. I didn't ask.
Is there a service elevator in this apartment?
Yes, in the kitchen. It opens onto a small lobby downstairs that opens onto the side street.
Stone nodded.
Play this straight, he said, or you are finished.
I will follow your instructions to the letter, Bellini said.
The doorbell rang, and Stone went and stood behind the curtain. He heard the door open, and more footsteps on the marble floor than he had expected. What sounded like Bellini and another man came into the living room.
"You were very foolish to do this, Gino," a man said. "It was entirely unintentional, Stan. Believe me. Give me your computer and I'll fix everything."
"In your study," Beria said. "I want to see your computer first."
Stone hadn't counted on this. He realized that he could see the study door from his position, and that meant that they would be able to see him from the study. Bellini, Beria, and another much larger man walked across the living room and entered the study. Beria sat down at Bellini's computer and began typing.
"The files are not here," he said.
"I told you that," Bellini replied.
"Now you fix my computer so that I can open the files safely," Beria said.
Stone could see Bellini as he sat down, opened Beria's laptop, and began typing. After a couple of minutes of this, Bellini said,
"There, it's fixed. You can open the files now. Try it, if you like."
Beria sat down and opened some files.
"It works," he said. "Now, you sit down at your computer."
Bellini did so.
"Now we will transfer the 20 million I sent you back into my account. Don't worry. When I have had this checked out, I will rewire it."
At this moment, Stone heard the front door open and the click of high heels on marble.
"Gino?"
a woman's voice called.
"I'm in the study," Gino called back. "I'll be there in a minute."
The woman walked across the living room and into the study. Stone realized that when they finished doing what they were doing, everyone would come back into the living room and they would see him. Everyone in the study was standing behind Gino, watching what he did on his computer.
"Now is the time," Stone said to himself.
He slipped out of his shoes, held them in one hand, and the pistol in the other, then started walking quickly and soundlessly across the living room.
"There, it's done," he heard Gino say.
"Done is correct," Beria replied.
Then a single gunshot rang out, and the woman screamed. Stone ran flat out for the kitchen, and as he did, there was a second gunshot. He found the service elevator and pressed the button. The lights on the panel told him the car was on the ground floor. It began to rise, too slowly to suit Stone. He pressed the button again, hoping to hurry it. Then he heard the footsteps of two men walking from the study back into the living room. He saw them go to the coffee table, and that meant that if they turned, they could see him, and there was nowhere to hide. The elevator still had 15 floors to go.
33.
Stone stared at the floor numbers of the elevator as they slowly changed.
"Let's get out of here," Beria said to his companion.
"Better see if there's a back way," the man replied.
The elevator door opened, Stone stepped into the car, and began looking for the correct number. Finally, he found G and pressed it, then slipped on his shoes and tucked the gun into his waistband. The door slid silently shut, but the car did not move. Stone was about to reach for the button again, but the door slid open and two men stood there. Beria was maybe 6 feet and 190 pounds. The other man was taller and a gorilla by any measure, maybe 300 pounds. They stared at Stone.
"Good morning,"
Stone said, backing up until he was leaning against the rear wall. Going down?
Thank you, yes, Beria said, stepping onto the elevator, followed by the gorilla.
The door slid shut again, and after another pause, the car started down.
Beria, who was leaning against the wall on Stone's left, said, "You live upstairs?"
"No, just visiting," Stone replied. The elevator seemed to inch down.
"Quite the building, eh?" Beria asked.
"Spectacular views," Stone replied.
"Who lives upstairs?" Beria asked.
"A woman of my acquaintance," Stone replied.
"And her husband?" Beria asked slyly.
"I'm afraid so. Fortunately, he's out of town."
Beria gave a short laugh, and the elevator stopped.
The door slid open, and the two men got off.
"Be careful," Beria said.
"Don't worry," Stone said, following them out of the elevator, but more slowly, hoping to put more distance between them. The two went through the outside door and turned right, toward Park Avenue. Stone turned left, got out his phone, and called Fred, who was waiting on Park.
"Yes, sir," Fred said.
"Meet me on the corner of 59th and Lex."
"Yes, sir."
Stone put away the phone and continued walking. As he did, a black S-Class Mercedes drove past him, and Beria waved from the rear seat. As Stone approached Lexington Avenue, the light changed, and the Mercedes stopped. The rear window slid down, and Beria said,
"Can I give you a lift somewhere?"
"Thank you, but my car is just around the corner," Stone replied with a little smile.
He turned left just as Fred drew up. The light changed. The Mercedes turned right and drove down Lex. Stone got into the Bentley.
"Fred," Stone said, "follow the Mercedes, but keep well back."
"Which Mercedes, sir?"
"The black S-Class."
"Which black S-Class?" Fred asked.
Stone looked ahead of them and saw two black Mercedeses driving a block down Lex ahead of them.
"Shit," Stone muttered.
"Let me know when you decide," Fred said.
"Do you know which one entered Lex from the direction I came?"
"I'm not sure," Fred replied.
"Be sure to keep up with the changing lights," Stone said. "We don't want to get stuck. If we get a red light, run it."
"As you wish, sir."
As Stone watched, the Mercedes in the left lane turned left on East 49th Street, and the other continued straight ahead.
"Follow the one that turned," Stone said, taking a flyer.
"Yes, sir."
The Mercedes continued east, stopping for a couple of lights. Then, as it approached First Avenue, it pulled over and stopped.
"Stop," Stone said.
Fred pulled over.
"The car has diplomatic plates," he said.
From half a block back, Stone watched as Beria and the gorilla got out of the Mercedes and went up the front stairs into a building. The Mercedes drove away.
"Continue," Stone said, "but I want to see what that building is, so go very slowly."
As they passed the building, Stone saw two brass plaques, one on each side of the large doors. The one on the left was unintelligible to him, since it was in the Cyrillic alphabet. The other, in English, read, "Permanent Mission of the Russian Federation to the United Nations."
"Okay," Stone said. "Home."
He waited until he was at his desk before he called Dino.
"Machete."
"It's Stone."
"I figured."
"How did you figure?"
"I don't know. I get a creepy feeling sometimes when the phone rings, which means it's you."
"I want to report a double murder."
"Then call the police," Dino said.
"Has the mayor fired you?"
"Not yet."
"Then you are the police."
"Yeah. But all I'm going to do is call homicide and tell them to get on it. So why don't you just call 911?
"Because I don't want to have to explain why I was where the murders took place."
"You're going to have to explain that to me,"
Dino pointed out. I have no problem with that. You're taking the call, then?
Yeah. Okay. Let me get a pencil.
Stone heard drawers opening and closing, then Dino came back on the line.
Okay, go.
Stone gave him the address and floor number of the building.
Okay, who got offed?
A man named Gino Bellini and his wife, Veronica.
The guy who hired Dirty Joe?
That's the one, Stone replied. Did I tell you that Dirty Joe and his girl are dead? They were shot while tracking us in Maine.
Yeah, you told me. That's Maine's problem,
Dino replied.
Who killed the Bellinis?
A man named Stanislav Beria and an unsub.
I know the name,
Dino said.
Beria is with the Russian UN mission.
Well, yes, I saw him go inside the mission, but he also works for Selwyn Owaki.
He can't work for Owaki. Beria is a legitimate Russian diplomat, Dino said. I met him at a cocktail party at the Russian embassy.
I don't question that, but Gino Bellini told me he works for Owaki.
Was this before or after Bellini was murdered? We could use a witness.
Before, obviously, and I'm a witness to both murders.
You actually saw them happen?
Yes. Well, more correctly, I heard them happen. One shot followed a moment later by another.
So you're not a witness?
Beria and his gorilla were the only other people in the apartment besides Bellini and his wife.
And you? You were in the apartment?
Yes, Dino, I was.
Were you in the room?
I was in the living room. Everybody else was in an adjoining study.
So you're not a witness?
I heard the shots.
From the next room?
Dino, Beria, his gorilla, and I were the only people in the apartment still standing, and I didn't kill them, so who's left?
Why didn't they kill you?
I was hiding behind a curtain, and while they were still in the study, I made a run for the service elevator in the kitchen.
Why didn't you take the regular elevator?
Because I didn't want to be seen by the front desk staff leaving the building.
Why? You say you didn't kill them.
That doesn't mean they wouldn't think I did.
Go on.
Then I rode down on the elevator with Beria and the gorilla.
Let me get this straight. You heard two people shot in the next room, then you rode down on the elevator with the shooters?
I was in the kitchen, waiting for the service elevator to arrive on my floor. I got in, the door closed, then it opened again, and Beria and the gorilla got in.
And they didn't notice you?
They did. I pretended to be visiting a woman upstairs.
What woman?
There was no woman, Dino. Beria asked if I lived upstairs, and I said no. I was visiting a woman whose husband was out of town.
Was this something derived from your own experience, Stone, visiting a woman whose husband is out of town?
No, Dino, I made it up so Beria wouldn't shoot me.
So where are the dead bodies?
Where they fell, in the study, I imagine. I suggest you get a team over there right now, then arrest Beria.
Beria is a Russian diplomat, and as such he carries a diplomatic passport and is immune from arrest, even for a double murder.
Then arrest the gorilla.
You want my people to appear at the Russian mission and ask for a gorilla?
I suggest you put a couple of men outside the mission. Since he and Beria appeared to be joined at the hip, when Beria leaves, arrest the gorilla.
I'm going to have a hard time getting an arrest warrant for a gorilla, Dino said. I don't think I'd even like to mention a gorilla to a grand jury, under oath.
I have done my duty as a citizen, Stone said. You want dinner tonight? P.J. Clark's at 7?
Is Meg still there?
Yes.
I'd love to have dinner with Meg. See you then.
Dino hung up, and so did Stone. 34.
Stone sent Fred over to Arthur Steele's office with the checks Arthur had signed. As Fred left for Steele's office, Joan buzzed Stone.
"Arthur Steele on one."
Stone pressed the button. "Hello, Arthur. Your checks are on their way back to you by hand."
"Which checks?"
"The ones you signed and gave to me."
"Which one did you give Bellini?"
"The one for $10 million, but he gave it back, sort of."
"You're sending me all four checks, then?"
"That is correct."
"Did you get the computer files you wanted?"
"Yes."
"Without paying for them?"
"Yes."
"Stone, forgive my asking, but how did you do that?"
"It's complicated, Arthur. I'll explain when I see you again."
"Stone, did you do something to Bellini? I don't want to be a party to anything like that."
"No, Arthur, and Bellini is dead, so I couldn't do anything to him."
"Did you kill him?"
"Of course not. Someone else did."
"I'm confused."
"I told you it was complicated, Arthur. All you need to know for now is that your checks are being hand-delivered to you now, and I got back the computer files, so there won't be an insurance claim."
"This sounds too easy, Stone. What are you keeping from me?"
"Arthur, please do this. Pretend that we didn't have lunch today and that you didn't give me any checks. You'll feel better."
"But what about Bellini? Am I going to be questioned by the police?"
"No, Arthur, you are not. Trust me. Have a drink and relax. Goodbye." Stone hung up. Stone and Meg had a drink in his study before leaving to meet Dino. "I have good news for you," Stone said, digging in his pocket and coming up with the thumb drive.
"What is that?" Meg asked.
"It contains the designs and specifications that Gino Bellini stole from you." She went to the computer on his desk, plugged in the thumb drive, and examined some of the files.
"How did you get them?"
she asked, returning to her chair. "Bellini gave me the drive."
"Why?"
"Because I gave him a check for $10 million.
"Your own $10 million?
"No, it was from Arthur Steele, but I've since returned the check to him."
"Gino gave you back the check?"
"I persuaded him to."
"How did you do that?"
"I told him that Dirty Joe had confessed to 2 Maine state police officers and an EMT, that he had been hired by Bellini to kill you, and that the 2 Maine cops were downstairs in his building waiting to arrest him."
"But that wasn't true, was it?"
"No, I lied."
"And that worked?"
"Yes."
"So what happens now? Is Gino still coming after me?"
"No, Gino is dead. Veronica, too."
"Good God, Stone. Did you kill them?"
"No, I did not kill them. You are the third person to whom I've had to deny that, and I'm getting tired of it."
"Stone, if you had killed Gino and Veronica, would you deny it to me?"
"No."
"Yes.
I mean, I didn't kill them, so there's no need to deny it."
"But you just did."
"Because I didn't."
"Are you telling me the truth?"
"Yes, and that's the last question I'm going to answer on the subject."
"If you didn't kill them, who did?"
"I just said I wouldn't answer any more questions about it." "Stone, listen very carefully. Gino and Veronica were killed by someone he had sold the stolen designs to, a man named Beria."
"Who works for an arms dealer."
"None of those names mean anything to me. It's not important that they do. Wait a minute. You said that Gino sold this man the designs?"
"Yes,
but he got them back."
"How?"
"Why are you keeping this from me?" "Tell you what. Tomorrow morning, when I'm sober and less tired, I will explain everything to you in detail. In the meantime, all you need to know is that you have your designs back. Arthur has his check back. Gino and Veronica are dead, and I didn't kill them. May we leave it that way until tomorrow morning?"
"I guess so."
"Thank you very much." Stone looked at his watch.
It's time we left for dinner.
With Dino and Viv?
Yes, or at least with Dino. Viv travels a lot on business, and she could be out of town. I didn't ask.
Do I have to keep this business about the designs from Dino?
No, I've already explained it to him.
Why Dino? Why not me first? I mean, they're my designs.
I had to report the murders to the police, so I called Dino as soon as possible.
Gino and Veronica were murdered?
Yes, I told you that.
You said they were dead.
Well, they didn't simultaneously drop dead of heart attacks. But you didn't kill them.
If you ask me that again, I'll have to kill myself, Stone replied.
You're going to have to explain all this to me later, Stone.
I've already promised to do so.
Shall we go?
Oh, all right.
35. They found Dino at the bar at P.J. Clark's, half a drink ahead of them.
"Where's Viv?" Meg asked.
"Somewhere in darkest California on business. Happens all the time. Our table is ready. You want to order your drinks in the dining room?"
"Sure," Stone said, and steered Meg that way. When they were seated and the drinks had been served, including another for Dino, he said,
"I assume Meg knows about this."
"About what?"
Meg asked.
"Yes, she knows," he turned to Meg, "about what I told you a few minutes ago."
"Oh, that."
"My people are taking Bellini's apartment apart as we speak," Dino said. "They were both in the study, as you said. One each in the head."
"Oh, God," Meg said. "I'm going to be sick."
"Why?"
Dino asked.
"You didn't get shot."
"No more details, please."
"I forgot to tell you," Stone said. "I took Bellini's gun from the apartment. I'll send it to you tomorrow."
"Why did you do that?"
"It was lying on the coffee table when the doorman rang to say Beria was on his way up, and Bellini was already in the study, so I stuck it in my belt. A little later, when I had to sneak out of there with my shoes in my hand, I thought I might need it for self-defense if Beria saw me. Then, in the elevator, I was glad I had it."
"Give it to my homicide detectives,"
Dino said.
"Which detectives?"
"The ones who will be calling on you first thing in the morning to question you about the murders."
"I had hoped to avoid that by going straight to the top," Stone said.
"You hoped in vain. We have procedures, remember?"
"Yes, yes."
"Stone," Meg said, "if you didn't kill them, why are the police questioning you?"
"Because Dino somehow neglected to tell them that I didn't kill them."
"I couldn't do that," Dino said. "They have to draw their own conclusions from evidence and the witnesses."
He turned to Meg.
"Stone is the only witness, so it's standard practice that he is the immediate suspect until the evidence clears him."
"What kind of evidence will clear him?" she asked.
"Beats me," Dino said. "I haven't visited the crime scene."
"Lack of motive," Stone said to her.
"I wouldn't lean too heavily on that," Dino said. "After all, you went to Bellini's apartment to get something he stole from your client. An objective person might conclude that he was reluctant to give it to you, and in the ensuing argument, you shot Bellini, then his wife, because she was a witness."
"An objective observer would not think that if he knew that I went to see Bellini with $70 million in checks of different amounts in order to buy the stolen designs back from him, and he accepted one for $10 million.
"They didn't find any checks,"
Dino said. "That's because I returned the checks to Arthur Steele, who gave them to me for the purpose of buying back the stolen designs."
"In that case, an objective observer might conclude that you murdered them to get back the $10 million,
Dino said.
"And a jury might very well accept that conclusion."
"Stone is going to trial?"
Meg asked. I am not, Stone said. When Dino's detectives have heard all the facts, they will move on to the next suspect, who is the person who killed them, one Stanislav Beria. I am your witness to that.
You didn't actually see Beria shoot them, and my people didn't find him in the apartment, Dino said.
Of course not. I trailed Beria and his guerrilla to the Russian mission. They'll find him there.
No, the Russians won't let them in, and even if they should find Beria off the reservation, he will decline to answer any questions because he's a certified diplomat and has a diplomatic passport to prove it.
Back to you, Stone, Meg said. I also have an excellent character witness, Stone said, who will tell the detectives that I would never murder anyone.
They would discount my testimony, Dino replied, because they know that we are very good friends, and that I would probably lie for you.
Probably?
Probably.
The ballistic evidence will show that the bullet did not come from any weapon I own.
Of course not, Dino said. You would have been unlikely to use a weapon that could be traced to you. In cases like this, the murderer often obtains an untraceable weapon, and anyway, he would ditch it at the first opportunity.
The doorman at Bellini's building will testify that Beria and the gorilla went up to Bellini's apartment, Stone said.
He will also testify that you went up to Bellini's apartment, Dino said blithely.
Your detectives will find no gunshot residue on my person or clothing, Stone said gamely.
You've had plenty of time to scrub your hands and send your clothes to be cleaned.
The waiter brought menus. I recommend the steaks, Stone said to Meg.
I think I've lost my appetite, she replied.
You should have the steak, though. I understand the food is terrible in prison. Stone took a deep breath and let it out.
Don't lose your temper, Stone, Dino said. There are half a dozen people here who know you and could testify that you have trouble controlling yourself.
The waiter came to take their order. Terry, Stone said to the man, have you ever known me to lose my temper?
Well, Terry said thoughtfully, there was that time when your steak arrived too rare and you threatened to murder the chef. Stone said, you know that was entirely in jest.
You didn't seem to be jesting, Terry replied, and you were sort of fondling your steak knife.
I rest my case, Dino said.
Stone ordered through clenched teeth. Dino and Meg ordered, too.
And a bottle of that cheap Cabernet that Stone always orders when he's buying, Dino said to the waiter. Gotcha, Terry said, then left.
Well, Dino, Meg said, I don't think Stone was very convincing about his anger problem.
Neither do I,
Dino replied. Stone polished off his drink and began to fondle his steak knife. 36. Stone was stonily silent in the car on the way home, and Meg didn't disturb him. Back at the house, they undressed, and Stone came to bed wearing a nightshirt, while Meg was naked as usual.
That's amusing, she said, nodding at the nightshirt.
You are easily amused, Stone replied. You've been amused all evening by Dino, who was, as usual, very amusing.
You thought I was serious about suspecting you of murder?
Were you not?
I was not, but perhaps I should revise my opinion.
Which is?
There you go. I was trying to amuse you, and you took it the wrong way, of course.
What do you mean, of course?
You've been intent all night on taking everything I said the wrong way.
I suppose I had trouble discerning between your speaking the wrong way and your speaking the right way, Stone said.
Hasn't it occurred to you that I would never suspect you of murder?
No, it has not, given the circumstances, and Dino had trouble coming down on the right side of that question as well.
Are you mad at me or mad at Dino?
Can't I be annoyed with you both simultaneously?
It's very unattractive when you are.
I plead guilty to being unattractive, but not to murder.
Meg got out of bed, went to her dressing room, and came back wearing a nightgown.
Good night, she said, climbing into bed, pulling the covers up to her chin, and turning on her side, away from Stone.
Sleep well, Stone grumbled. It seemed to him that Meg fell asleep immediately, which made him even angrier. He got very little sleep that night.
Stone woke from a fitful sleep, with sunlight streaming through a window where he had forgotten to close the curtains. He reached for Meg, but found Bob instead, his tail thumping against the bed. Stone could hear Meg's shower running. He rang Helene and ordered breakfast, then found the Times where it had been slid under the door, and got back into bed, switching on Morning Joe, and pressed the remote control that sat him up and pointed him at the TV. Meg came out of the bathroom in a terry robe, toweling her hair.
"Good morning," he said.
"Good morning."
"I ordered breakfast for us."
"I'm not very hungry."
"That's what you said last night, and you ate a steak, then some of mine."
"Do you think I'm getting fat?"
"I don't know. I haven't seen your body for about 36 hours."
She whipped off the robe and posed for him.
"There, dear. Is that better?"
Stone looked up from his paper. "You're not getting fat," he said.
"I'm so relieved."
Breakfast came, and they both ate everything on the tray.
"Now I'm getting fat," she said.
"Don't worry about it."
"Are we still angry with each other?" she asked.
"I'm not angry," Stone replied. "I'm disappointed."
"Disappointed in me?"
"I don't know what you want," he said.
"I've kept you from being shot twice.
I've recovered $500 million of computer files and kept those files from being sold to a notorious arms dealer who could have sold them to anybody.
Oh, and I murdered the man who ordered you killed. Is that not enough?"
"You murdered Bellini?" she asked, horrified. "Of course not. That was a joke."
"It wasn't very funny."
"Funny? I thought it was."
"I didn't think it was funny, and I have a great sense of humor."
"That's what people with no sense of humor always say."
She sighed. "I'm tired of this," she said.
"We have that in common, if little else."
"Stone, I am no longer comfortable with this contentiousness."
"Then may I suggest, in the kindest possible way, that you not put up with it any more, and conduct your search for an apartment from a hotel. I'll have Fred drive you to anyone you like."
She threw off the covers and marched into the bathroom. The hairdryer could be heard for a while, and it was followed by the sounds of suitcases being opened, packed, and closed again. Stone buzzed Fred and asked him to get the car ready, and to come and get her luggage.
"Then take Miss Harmon wherever she likes," he said, and hung up.
Fred knocked on the door just as she was leaving the dressing room, fully dressed.
"Come in," he shouted. Fred came in.
"Yes, sir."
"Her luggage is in the dressing room."
Fred collected the bags and took them downstairs.
"Well," she said.
"I hope you find what you're looking for," Stone said.
"So do I," she said, walking out of the room and slamming the door.
"I meant an apartment," he shouted after her.
He muted Joe Scarborough's daily rant about small government, then went back to his Times. An hour later, as Stone was getting dressed after his shower, the phone buzzed.
"Yes?"
"There are 2 homicide detectives down here," Jones said, "and they want to see you."
"Tell them to go to—"
No, Jones said.
I'm not telling them that. They might arrest me.
Have they shown you an arrest warrant? He asked.
Not yet.
Tell them I'll be right down.
He knotted his tie and slipped on his jacket.